Thank you so much, Tony, for that very kind introduction. And welcome, everybody, to APHA in Denver. It is absolutely great to see this packed room. It is a great honor to be leading off on this very important summit. And I really want to thank you for the added commitment that you have shown by coming here a day early to learn about health reform and what you can do to make it a reality for millions of Americans across this country. Only the truly committed would come a day early to hear about this. And it's a wonderful opportunity for us to meet each other and to renew our commitment to making healthcare better and to make public health and prevention come alive. And it's always a joy to see such wonderful friends from the past and to make new friends for the future. I also want to congratulate my very close friend, Dr. Georges Benjamin. He's been doing this for a long, long time. I think he deserves a special round of applause here. Thanks, Georges. And to Dr. Navarez, congratulations for an excellent year of leadership as president of APHA. For those of you who do not know me, I am a physician. I've cared for patients for over 30 years. I am a former state health commissioner, as you heard from my colleague. I'm a former researcher at Harvard School of Public Health, but no honor matches that of serving as the Assistant Secretary for Health in the administration that made health reform a reality for the American people. So I treasure this opportunity. Every day on this job is a gift, and now I also feel it's our responsibility to make it come alive for the people of the United States. So over the next hour or so, I'll be telling you at a reasonably high level about the main aspects of this transformative act and try to make some special comments on the parts that apply particularly to prevention, coverage, and to public health. Now, how do I advance here? The left click? So this act, as you well know, was passed on March 23rd of this year. This administration made possible something that was thought to be impossible by previous administrations. And then on September 23rd, we celebrated the six-month anniversary. And that was a very important date because we could finally begin to start collecting stories from people who have already been impacted by the passage of this transformative law. About 50 stories were collected and put up on a White House website. whitehouse.gov/health reform. And as the president has mentioned repeatedly, the stories of everyday Americans, and more importantly, the courage it took to share those stories is what kept this effort alive. So through this presentation, I will share some of these human stories that are on that website. Please go on that website and hear these stories and collect them in your hometowns and send them to us, because with every passing day, you will see how this law really makes a difference for people across the country. Let me just start by saying that this law is absolutely stunning in its comprehensive reach, in its breadth, and in its depth. And for those of you who have not clicked on through this on the website or read it in detail in print, there are 10 titles or 10 chapters. Chapters that are dedicated to health care, of course, quality, affordable health care, to public programs, to improving quality in particular. Title 4 is one that is of particular importance to this audience, prevention and improving public health. That's the title I read and reread and reread many, many, many times. Title 5 has to do with workforce. You'll be hearing from our wonderful HRSA Administrator Mary Wakefield on this critical topic. Title 6 is on transparency and program integrity. Title 7 has to do with cutting-edge medical research and innovative medical therapies. Title 8 has to do with a new voluntary program for long-term care called the CLASS Act. Title 9 has to do with revenues. And Title 10 reauthorizes the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act, basically puts forward in motion once again the Indian Health Service led by my colleague, Dr. Yvette Rubidoux, which cares for some 1.9 million American Indians and Alaskan Natives. For this presentation, I want to focus on five major themes that are critical to all of us in this room and to everybody in this country. First, expanding coverage in multiple ways, as you will hear. Secondly, affording new consumer protections and consumer choice. Third, making healthcare more affordable. Four, improving quality, a growing theme, not just in healthcare, but in broader population health. And fifth, and perhaps most important, improving prevention and public health. So let's go through each of these five themes and see what the provisions are all about and see how this really touches lives of people in our communities all across this country. The law is projected to expand coverage to some 32 million people by 2014. So 2014 is a very important watershed year. By that year, states will have established exchanges, new private competitive health insurance marketplaces throughout the country, and offer individuals and small businesses a choice of affordable qualified plans. I'm from Massachusetts, and I'm very proud to see how Massachusetts passed health reform in 2006, established their own exchange by the end of that year called the Connector, and because of that effort and many others, driven the rates of the uninsured down to the lowest in the country. And it's going to be great to hear from my very, very good friend and successor and colleague, Commissioner John Auerbach, in just a little bit about the experience of Massachusetts in passing health reform and establishing the exchange and the connector there. Also in 2014, Medicaid eligibility will be expanded to 133% of federal poverty level across the country. That's about $14,000 per person in terms of income eligibility, or $29,000 for a family of four. So between now and 2014, a number of so-called bridge programs have been established because we want to get people who need insurance into coverage as soon as possible and ease suffering and make a difference. So three of those so-called bridge programs are the Pre-Existing Condition Insurance Plan, PSIP — everything in government has an acronym, I'm sorry — the Early Retiree Reinsurance Program, and the Small Business Health Insurance Tax Credits. Let's hear a little bit more about these three bridge programs that are already underway, making a difference in the lives of people, and even meet some of the people whose lives are affected by these bridge programs to 2014. I hope you've all heard about the Pre-Existing Condition Insurance Plan, the PSIP, and this offers new coverage for those who are uninsured for at least 6 months and denied coverage because of an illness or pre-existing condition. I think one story that is particularly touching for me as a physician who has trained in cancer is to hear about Gail O'Brien from New Hampshire. She was diagnosed with high-grade non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in March, and I know, and we all know, that that's a life-threatening illness. It requires treatment immediately, but she was uninsured. She did not have the funds to start treatment, and she waited until July when the Pre-Existing Condition Insurance Plan program was begun, and then was able to begin coverage, and I hear is doing very well under treatment. So she is a very grateful person who has already been touched by the Pre-Existing Condition Insurance Plan. Similarly, Michael Story, pictured here below, is a man from Mississippi who could not get health coverage for 3 years because of a pacemaker. He is now getting coverage through the Pre-Existing Condition Insurance Plan. These are two of some 8,000 people who are now enrolled in these plans across the country. Some of the plans are run by the states. Some are run by the federal Pre-Existing Condition Insurance Plan. But these are individuals who were desperately in need of care and now have received care because of health reform. Let's hear about Gail O'Brien, if we could make the video work, and see if we can hear directly from herself how this new law has touched her life.
We're pretty healthy people, you know. We work out, we eat right, we do all the right things, you know. Something like that's not in the family, you know. So that was the last thing from my mind.
We thought that I didn't have cancer. We thought it was one of these other things that I was being tested for. My doctor had said to me when I was diagnosed with cancer, it's either going to be you're going to have to go into your retirement fund or you're going to die. Those are your choices.
We knew that Gail wasn't going to be insured and off. It's like everybody's at this party, you're not invited to this party. You were on the outside. We worked just as hard as anyone else does, but we don't get the insurance. It just didn't seem fair anyway.
When that was signed, I mean, that just changed my life completely because then I knew I could get the treatments and I would be okay. I have an appointment, I go and I feel good. I know I'm getting treated.
Yeah,
Hello? Yes, this is her.
Hi, I have a personal line of communication.
Oh, really?
Yes. Hey. Hold on 1 second, I'm just going
to... Thank you.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi, Gail.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing really well.
Thank you. This is an honor. I want to thank you so much. Because if it wasn't for you, I probably wouldn't be here right now.
Well,
and this is that's from the bottom of my heart.
Well, it could be looking good. It means so much. You had had trouble buying health insurance before the pre-existing condition. Fund got set up, is that right?
Right, I couldn't. There was no way I could. I was denied.
We didn't know this at the time, but I think it turned out that you were the first person in the state to sign up for this fund. So you're like the poster child for why this is so necessary and why we're so proud of the reforms that we initiated. You know, it's still a battle that you're fighting, but now you've got some allies on your side and you don't have to spend all your time worrying about paying the bills.
You're right. Yes, thank you so much.
Michelle and I are thinking of you, and I really appreciate you being willing to tell your story because I think what happened to you and your family can happen to anybody, and that's sort of one of the main messages that we want to deliver to people.
Yes, exactly. You're right.
All right. Well, Gail, it was great to talk to you.
You too. I'm so honored. Wait till I go back to work. They're all going to be jealous.
Tell everybody I said hi.
I will. Thank you so much. There was the president. That was so cool. There are people out there that don't have health care, that need it. And all the time, you always think, am I still going to be here now? You know, but now, because I'm getting treatments, it's a little one.
Isn't that great? Thank you. So I'm from Massachusetts, and she lives actually very close to me. And so this is very personal to me as I hear this story and watch how Gail is doing now on coverage. And we know that thousands of people will be receiving coverage through this pre-existing plan. So that's really what makes this so rewarding for so many of us as we start implementing this new law. Let's quickly describe another bridge program that got started just in a matter of months, and it's already making a difference, the Early Retiree Reinsurance Program. And you know that for people who retire early before they're eligible for Medicare, can go on and buy coverage through the individual market, but those premiums are skyrocketing, and lots of times people suffer tremendous financial hardship just to keep basic coverage. And in fact, the percentage of large firms that are providing workers with so-called early retiree health coverage has dropped from about two-thirds in 1988 to about half that today. So this new early retiree reinsurance program, funded by some $5 billion, will help employers provide coverage to early retirees age 55 to 64 who are not yet eligible for Medicare, as well as their spouses and dependents. When this initiative was put forward by the Department of Health and Human Services, there was tremendous nationwide interest. Some 3,000 applications from employers, half of the Fortune 500 companies across the United States, all major unions and government entities in all 50 states. So for large firms that are interested in being part of this program, they can visit this website, errp.gov, and we're looking forward to this bridge program coming fully alive very, very rapidly again to cover vulnerable people. And then I hope you've all heard about the small business health insurance tax credits. About 1 in 3 Americans work for firms that have 100 or fewer employees. And many of these small businesses are really getting hit especially hard by health insurance costs. And it's particularly the businesses that have some 25 FTEs or less that are really getting disproportionately burdened. So here is an example of a bookshop owner in Salt Lake City, Betsy Burton, and her story was featured in the New York Times on September 17th. I found this article particularly compelling. It really humanized the challenges of running a small business for someone like Ms. Burton, who has 25 employees, and she's paying insurance for some 7 of them, describing how health costs are going up every year, describing about how she was concerned about caring for her own employees, but also keeping her business going. But now, some 4 million small businesses are eligible for these tax credits that immediately can give employers up to 35% of their contribution to their employees' health insurance. That percentage goes up to some 50% by 2014. And so Betsy Burton is quoted in this article by saying, "These people," that is her employees, "really need insurance, and I'm right there with them. I have a son with special needs, and I don't know what would be happening to him or us without this insurance." So those are some examples of how these bridge programs are already making a difference in the lives of people around this country. Now, the way of expanding coverage through the Affordable Care Act is also impressive in many other ways. It is now projected to extend the Medicare Trust Fund for an additional 12 years from 2017 to 2029. So that makes Medicare more secure for the 45 million people who are covered under Medicare. And then also, because young adults have particularly high rates of uninsurance, the law covers now adult dependent children through age 26. This provision applies to all plans that are new or renewed after September 23rd, the 6-month anniversary. So one person who has benefited from this is Aaron Yehuda, age 24, a rabbinical college student. Because he is now covered under this new provision, he can focus his savings on his education and not his health care for at least another couple of years till he can get his own career launched. And then you have heard a tremendous amount about how this law really invests in community health centers and the primary care workforce. I think a tremendous example of putting resources where we need them the most in the healthcare systems. Community health centers, as you know, serves some 1 in 3 low-income people in the United States, some 19 million clients at some 8,000 sites. The law now invests about $11 billion over the next 5 years for expansion, for new construction, and for new sites. Again, Administrator Wakefield, who's an outstanding public servant, will be addressing you later on today to tell you more about that. And we are also very pleased that there's great emphasis on expanding the primary care workforce through the Affordable Care Act, particularly for providers in underserved areas. And there are incentives to expand not just physicians, but also nurses, physician assistants, and many other primary providers, with the projection that some 16,000 new primary care providers will be supported through the efforts of the Recovery Act and the Affordable Care Act. Let's move on to the second major theme, that is offering new consumer protections and consumer choice. Previously, kids like the one you can see here could be denied coverage simply because they were ill, because they had a pre-existing condition. The new law now bans that, and that ban applies to all group plans sold after March 23rd when the new law was signed by the president. And then the denial of coverage will extend to all people with pre-existing conditions by 2014. Previously, insurance companies could drop coverage if an applicant made an unintentional mistake on an application, and the company could rescind that coverage. Now that is banned as well. Previously, seriously ill patients would be very concerned about reaching lifetime limits on coverage if they were struggling with issues like cancer or debilitating illness. Now, the limit on lifetime dollars for coverage has been lifted. So these three provisions are part of what's called the Patient's Bill of Rights. These three more provisions also are part of the Patient's Bill of Rights. Previously, some beneficiaries across the country did not have rights to appeal insurance company decisions. Now all beneficiaries have that right to appeal. Previously, insurance companies could choose your MDs in some cases. Now everyone has the right to choose their own MD in their own network. In some cases, insurance companies could restrict emergency care and where you went to receive emergency care. Now there's a new ban on such restrictions, and new plans cannot charge more in cost sharing for emergency services out of network. So these three provisions and the three on the previous slide are part of this very important Patient's Bill of Rights that have received a lot of attention in recent months. The third theme I mentioned is making healthcare more affordable. What I am particularly excited about, and I know you are too, is that previously there have been so many cost barriers to getting good preventive services. Now, for individuals to get high-value prevention services, there will be no cost barriers for those in new plans. And so all new plans must cover certain high-value clinical preventive services, the so-called A and B recommended services from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices for the CDC, and other respected policy groups. If you are an elder person on Medicare, you worry about costs, particularly if you are one who needs many prescription medications, and the cost of those medications happen to fall into this coverage gap called the donut hole. There are some 4 million seniors who are vulnerable to paying 100% of the prescription drug costs in that donut hole. The law provides to close that hole steadily, starting immediately. And in fact, already this year, some 1.8 million seniors have received a $250 rebate check because their Part D prescription drug costs have fallen to that donut hole. That donut hole will be closed by 2020. And also, beneficiaries who are on Medicare Part D will get a 50% discount on their prescription drug costs starting 2011 and beyond. I already mentioned that the new marketplaces, the exchanges established in 2014, will have subsidized premiums. So if you have a low income and your salary is between 133 and 400% of the federal poverty level, you may be eligible for certain tax credits and subsidies. And then the department is trying to make sure that state by state, insurance companies are being held accountable to be transparent about why they increase rates and how much they increase rates. Rates should be raised for reasonable reasons and not what is considered unreasonable. And so some $250 million in grants over the next 5 years will be distributed across the country to every state to make sure that insurance companies follow those guidelines. Some $1 million has already been provided to each of 45 states and the District of Columbia to make sure that those processes are more consumer-friendly and transparent. Theme number four is quality, and this is a very exciting area for those of us who have been in healthcare, and increasingly for those of us who are in population health and prevention. We are absolutely delighted to have, as a new CMS administrator, my colleague and good friend, Dr. Don Berwick, a true visionary in healthcare, in public health, and in quality. And under his new leadership, a new CMS Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation is being stood up. It will have some $10 billion to disseminate over the next 10 years for demonstration projects, testing new ways of delivering patient care, new methods for coordinating care, new ways of improving quality and reducing rate of growth and costs for Medicare, Medicaid, and the Children's Health Insurance Program. Dr. Berwick has established a personal oversight of this new innovation center because he sees this as a wave of the future. And he has also expressed tremendous interest in doing more in population health as well as in the direct healthcare setting. So our office and his office has been collaborating very closely on a number of projects that we hope to share with you in the very, very near future. In January of this year, the department is required to put forward a new national strategy for quality improvement. There's a work group at the department being led by Peter Lee of the Office of Health Reform, by my very close colleague, Dr. Carolyn Clancy of ARC, you'll be hearing from her later on today, and by Dr. Berwick. And so you'll see more national commitment to unified strategies on quality. Back to CMS, you know that till now, the purchasing has really been based on quantity and volume, when we should have the purchasing targeted more toward quality and value. And so there is language in the new law to move value-based purchasing forward, that's hospital-based, to make hospital performance more publicly reported in critical areas like myocardial infarction, heart failure, pneumonia, surgical care, and then healthcare-associated infections, an area that is of great interest to many of us in the department, in our office of the Assistant Secretary for Health, and to the White House, and I know to the country, and you'll be hearing much more about that in the future. We want to make sure that when a person pays his or her premiums, that that money is being used in the best possible way, in the most efficient way, and be used for health and quality, and not necessarily for administration and overhead. So there are new provisions that require large employer plans to dedicate at least 85% of their premium dollars to health and quality. If you are part of an individual or a small employer plan, that number is 80%. And if insurance companies do not meet these goals, they must provide rebates to consumers. This is all part of the so-called medical loss ratio conversation. That's a term which I think is very unfortunate, very hard to explain to the general public. But basically, when you're explaining it, it's if you're paying a premium, and it's a hefty premium, the vast majority of that cost should be dedicated to protecting you and your family and your health, and not to administration and overhead. And that's what the medical loss ratio provision addresses. We are very, very excited that at this meeting, we are unveiling new efforts to discuss quality at the public health broad level, at the population level. And I am particularly dedicated to my colleague, Dr. Peggy Honore, who is in the audience, who has worked very closely with Dr. Benjamin at APHA, and many of you in this room, colleagues from ASTHO, Dr. Paul Jarris from NACHO, Bobby Pestrunk, and many others who came in and helped us develop a new document and a new way of looking at quality from a population point of view, not just from a hospital or healthcare point of view. We are now in a new phase of public health conversation where we really need to advance conversations of public health quality in its broadest sense, that is building better systems to give all people what they need to reach their full potential for health. And the Affordable Care Act gives us a chance to link the clinic and the community and have quality be the theme that brings us together. At this meeting, Dr. Honore, supported by APHA leaders, will be unveiling this new report, Priority Areas for Improvement of Quality in Public Health, offering 9 new aims for public health quality that should be population-centered, equitable, proactive, health-promoting, risk-reducing, vigilant, transparent, effective, and efficient. Again, APHA, ASTHO, NACHO, many other groups have joined in a public health quality forum to get us to this very critical unveiling, and we're very grateful to all of you. And then the last critical theme, one that I think is just so exciting for everybody here and for the country, is that the Affordable Care Act puts prevention front and center in the conversation. And until now, in the public debate, we really haven't heard much about the preventive measures. But I believe in many ways that this is the part that may really have a tremendous legacy moving forward. I already mentioned that cost is a barrier for many people receiving good preventive services, counseling, preventive services, screenings. Studies have shown that Americans receive only about half the clinical preventive services that are recommended. As a physician who has cared for patients for over 30 years, I know that health is a gift, and the only way to protect that gift is through the power of public health and the power of prevention. And now through the Affordable Care Act, we can promote prevention for individuals, for businesses, for states, and indeed for the entire nation. Thank you. Thank you. And in so doing, we are also very committed to reducing and eliminating health disparities and achieving true health equity. Again, as a clinician and as a provider, I have seen too often how disadvantaged populations carry too much of the burden of illness in this society. As a Korean American and as a son of immigrants, I feel like I have lived this story personally and professionally. So all these themes resonate with me deeply. So it was a great pleasure to write in the New England Journal about 2 months ago with the secretary, this article referenced on the bottom, promoting prevention through the Affordable Care Act. And we were very pleased to put this perspective before the healthcare and public health community and highlight the importance of prevention in the Affordable Care Act. Let's just hit the highlights of some of these provisions. For individuals, we have mentioned already that people can now get preventive care without cost sharing, without out-of-pocket costs for new plans, if those services are high-value services determined by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or other highly respected groups. For people in public programs like Medicare, new annual wellness visits will be established with high-risk assessments and prevention planning rolled out at a very personalized level. In Medicaid, with the leadership of Dr. Berwick and Cindy Mann, we are having much more accelerated conversation about prevention, and we are hoping that programs that eliminate cost sharing for such services can be eligible for enhanced federal matching funds. The law mentions workplace wellness, authorizes funds for grants for small businesses because we spend so much time at work. Our workplace should be healthy. We should be encouraging employee wellness and prevention. The secretary is now required through the act to assess current federal health and wellness initiatives. As the assistant secretary in a department that has some 70,000 employees, we are talking daily about how to nurture and encourage the health of federal employees who work at HHS. The law directs CDC to survey worksite health policies and programs nationally and bring renewed attention there. We are also bringing these conversations of prevention to the community level, and our colleagues at the CDC, Dr. Frieden, Dr. Arias, who you're going to hear from later on today, have led a so-called Communities Putting Prevention to Work that funded community-wide prevention activities focused on obesity and tobacco. Here's an example of a group in Texas that received one of these grants and used it to increase physical activity in their community using a social determinants approach, a broad community-wide approach. And there is an opportunity through new national funding through so-called community transformation grants to advance these themes even more. And then on a national level, a new national prevention, health promotion, and public health council has been established. You will hear from my colleague, Dr. Regina Benjamin, the Surgeon General, immediately after I finish about the status of this council. and how it is working across government to create a new prevention strategy due in March. We are working to build on the foundations of healthy people, and we're working to build on the foundations and the experience of everybody here, because you really know what it takes to build healthy communities and healthy neighborhoods. The new funding from this Prevention and Public Health Fund made some $500 million new dollars available in fiscal year 10, and that figure is projected to grow to some $2 billion annually, so some $15 billion over the first 10 years of this new fund. And that fund will invest in new prevention activities across the country. Last year, we spent on areas such as the workforce, on integrating behavioral health and primary care, on HIV, on tobacco, and other issues. So these are new opportunities for all of us, and the creation of this new dedicated funding is critically important to making prevention come alive at the national level. And then reducing disparities, a key theme for public health, achieving true health equity, will come because there's tremendous attention in the Affordable Care Act of coordinating care, accentuating the potential for medical homes, new accountable care organizations through Medicare, promoting the importance of initiatives to increase diversity in the workforce, and new specific language to collect data on any ongoing or new federal health program for women and racial and ethnic minorities at the very least, and hopefully for many other groups. And again, we need as much data as possible to understand how disparities are affecting us and then how we can resolve and eliminate them. If you want more specifics about how this all affects public health, again, our piece in the New England Journal 2 months ago has several paragraphs on how this affects tobacco and obesity. For example, there's now coverage for tobacco use counseling, for obesity screening, for coverage of tobacco dependence advances for pregnant women on Medicaid, an issue that you'll be hearing much more about in the upcoming week, about states' Medicaid drug coverage, which can no longer exclude smoking cessation drugs by 2014. There are menu labeling provisions for chain restaurants that have to do with raising awareness about nutritional options. This is all part of the public health approach of the Affordable Care Act. Now, as I close, this is just an incredible amount of information, and I've tried to make this as organized as possible, but we have an outstanding website, because I know you have many, many questions. This website was launched on July 1, and it is very user-friendly and has been received very positively, healthcare.gov. Please go on this website. It has insurance options for you by zip code. It has prevention options for you. There is a Spanish language website that was also launched on September 8th, and we are very pleased at the public outreach that is afforded by this really wonderful website that really reaches people. As I finish, I do want to stress that the whole purpose of all this is to make our country healthier, our people healthier. As the Assistant Secretary, I have the incredible privilege of helping to unveil the next iteration of Healthy People in December. This only happens every 10 years. This is the year. And Healthy People 2020 now has 4 overarching goals: to achieve health equity, to eliminate preventable disease, disability, and injury, to promote quality of life across the lifespan. This is a gift. We have to protect it across the lifespan. And 4th, create social and physical environments that promote the good health for all, really using a social determinants approach. My final slide comes from my favorite statement of Healthy People, and this is where we all come in, because the health of the individual is almost inseparable from the health of the larger community, and the health of every community determines the overall health status of the nation. What you do, where you live, where you work, in your community makes a difference for public health. With the passage of the Affordable Care Act, with this administration in place, we can work together to really make a healthy people for 2020 and beyond. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank Dr. Koh for an excellent, I mean, the best overview I've seen of the Affordable Care Act in its full scope. And to do it in such a short period of time, so comprehensively, that's an incredible feat. Well done. Just for those of you who might be curious, the actual slides will be made available to you as well following this meeting on a website that APHA will establish, and the overview is in your manual. So now we have microphones set up, and we have about 10 minutes for questions. So if you have questions, go line up for Dr. Koh. And why don't we start over? I can't see you. I think I know who you are. Yes, go ahead.
Gene Matthews, University of North Carolina. I wonder, Dr. Koh, if you would comment a little further regarding the June decision to divert $250 million of the Prevention Trust Fund to direct care. That was obviously a matter of some disappointment to some of us.
Well, we're very pleased to have new funding that is going to happen not just in 2010, but for many years in the future. So, of course, when new funds are made available, we have many options and many possible ways that funding could be disseminated. And I think with such new opportunity, it's going to be impossible to get unanimity about how best those funding's decisions should be made and where it should go. For 2010, the decision was made to make a one-time-only commitment to improving the primary care workforce through those funds. The primary care workforce is needed to make prevention come alive. It's particularly needed at the clinic level. So we view that as a good and important investment in prevention that occurred in fiscal year 2010. For fiscal year 2011 and beyond, the workforce shouldn't be an option because we're moving on to other areas. And I should add, of course, that the workforce commitment was for about half those funds. The other half were for the areas I just described, for infrastructure, for primary care and behavioral health, for HIV, tobacco, and many other areas.
Well, with all due respect, when the master settlement agreement...
We have a lot of people lined up. We don't have a lot of time. So I'm going to go over here to this line here.
Yes, good morning. My name is Toni Sullivan. I'm a retired nurse educator, administrator, a dean, in other words. And I'm also a public health specialist. I retired in time to become very active in politics and in the Obama campaign and continuing on. And one of the things that I have done is I have done actual presentations throughout Orange County, California, South Orange County, that is most Republican, and have been trying to educate people about this healthcare reform. And I love it, I'm so excited about it, and I love all our language, I love social justice and equitability and all, but I'll tell you, come home with me and listen to the crap, you know, that I hear about all of this, and you watch TV at all or whatever, if you're alive. I mean, you know, I know it's a big issue and I want to raise it and hope that everybody can keep it in mind. And I'm wondering, is there any kind of particular educational guidelines that are going to be provided to people, you know, I don't know how to put it, to help people to educate the community about this. About the healthcare reform. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And first, let me thank you for your dedication. And we're all public health professionals here. And one thing we know about public health is that change does not come easily. And we need perseverance. We need incredible commitment. We got to encourage each other, and we need perseverance. Just having this law passed, many times people said it could not be done. It is now the law of the land. So that alone is enormous. And yeah, thank you. Thank you. No one said implementation was going to be easy, but we are making great progress. We're touching the lives of lots of people, and you heard some of those stories today. So I think we have to encourage each other, keep the perseverance going. The other couple themes I would put before you is that, again, being from Massachusetts, I've seen how health reform there has led to such low rates of the uninsured, and Commissioner Auerbach will tell us more about that. And public support there is high because the communication has been strong and sustained in the last 3 or 4 years. If we continue to collect stories about how people are affected by this, who wants to take away Gail O'Brien's insurance right now? Who wants to take away insurance from the people whose lives we have touched, as you have just seen here? Who wants all these prevention initiatives to be drawn back so it's a barrier again? I don't think anybody in the country does. So we just have to keep pushing that message, talking about it, encouraging each other, and I am convinced in the long run that this is going to make a difference for millions and millions of Americans.
Next.
I'm Jennifer Delahaye from the Department of Health in Arkansas. We find that in our state, the majority of adults don't have the health literacy skills they need to manage their own health or navigate the healthcare system as it exists. Of course, there's a number of changes that will be coming with healthcare reform. Are there measures or plans to help address this issue? Because if people don't have the health literacy skills they need, it doesn't matter what we do with healthcare reform.
Thank you. That's an outstanding point, and your timing is excellent. I have in the audience Rear Admiral Penny Slade Sawyer of our Office of Disease Prevention Health Promotion. That office has promoted a new health literacy plan for the department and the nation. It's going to be getting much more attention moving forward. The Institute of Medicine has also backed those efforts. And I think you're absolutely right. I think some of the challenges right now is that we've explained the new law more in insurance language than in day-to-day health language, the way that all people can understand. So you are absolutely right. Let's keep talking about how we communicate this critically important transformative law in ways that an everyday person can understand, because once they do, they will see the incredible impact that this can make on the lives of every person in this country.
Yeah.
All right, Dr. Stephen Tapp from the National Cancer Institute. The question I have is that, and I want to thank you and the administration for the scope of your vision and for the beauty of the vision, but obviously that vision scared the heck out of a lot of people. And so the question I have is really in the name and in the communication challenge we have of talking about whether in fact this is affordable. And I wonder if you could explain a little bit more on the economic basis and the economic argument that in fact this is affordable and that the vision is not going to break the bank.
Thank you. Thank you. First of all, thank you, Steve. Steve's commitment to cancer control and public health has been extraordinary, and he has a wonderful track record, so I want to thank you for that. There are projections by the Congressional Budget Office, an impartial office, that sees cost savings for the country of over $100 billion in the first decade and by close to some $1 trillion in the decade after that. If you saw the piece in the New York Times yesterday by Peter Orszag, the former OMB director for the Obama administration, he highlights those critically important themes and also goes through some of the arguments about why that message has been hard to communicate. So we know that there's going to be affordable on many levels, and most importantly, it's going to be affordable for the individual for the many reasons that I just pointed out on this presentation. And when people see that, people on Medicare who are seeing their prescription drug costs break the bank right now, but see that relief coming, when people see their rates on their insurance plans start to not go up in these extraordinary ways because of rate review, when people see new subsidized opportunities on exchanges after 2014, I think the country will start to feel it both on the macro level and at the individual level.
Yes, my name is Rochelle Clark, and I'm with the Department of Veteran Affairs Health Administration Center. And I was wondering if there was going to be some sort of consolidation with regulations as they pertain to the CHAMP VA program, as they also pertain to TRICARE, with the PPACA, especially considering that CHAMP VA by regulations does not cover preventative care.
Thank you. I think coordinating with the Department of Defense and TRICARE is a very important theme. I have some familiarity with that as one who oversees the Commissioned Corps, some 6,500 public health service officers in uniform. So yes, those conversations are ongoing, and we need the strongest collaboration between HHS and DOD and the VA to make sure that all these efforts are coordinated as closely as possible.
We're going to try to take maybe three more questions, and hopefully they can be quick so we can stay on schedule. So over here.
Hi, my name is Ken Spangler. I'm, like you, I've been a practicing physician for 30 years in the area, though, of emergency medicine, so that's where the rubber meets the road.
That's right.
And I'm also involved in public health in the academic setting. My concern is that the emergency health care system is already broken. The most recent survey in 2008 shows that 58% of all hospitals are at or over capacity in their emergency services almost all the time. On top of that, if history is prologue, we increased in the second decade after the passage of EMTALA from 1998 to 2008, the numbers of community health care recipients increased by over 300%. The number of primary care physicians increased by 66%, and yet the number of visits allowing for increases in population increased 27%. This is far too expensive a place to be getting convenient health care. Is there any provision in this to do something definitive about misuses or re-triage or something to adjust EMTALA so that people can be redirected to more appropriate healthcare sources?
Well, thank you very much. And I often point out that emergency physicians are in some ways tremendous public health leaders because they get to see every day what happens when public health doesn't work. They see it right in front of them. They get to see every day what happens when prevention doesn't work. And this issue I dealt with a lot as a state health commissioner in Massachusetts. And I know that Commissioner Auerbach has also, like every state health official, has worked very hard on this. And you know and I know that emergency department overcrowding is just a sign and a barometer of a system failure. And we need better systems of patient flow in through ED, in through EDs, up into the medical floors and into the ICUs and then out. And we are at 100% capacity, sometimes more in bad flu seasons. So far, we don't have a bad flu season yet this year, but we have to be very, very cautious about that. So building better systems of care and involving the emergency professionals is absolutely critical to the future of this act and also to public health and healthcare going forward.
I'm sorry, last question.
Gary Goldman, health officer and director for the Snohomish Health District, just north of Seattle, Washington. I'm about to make recommendations to the healthcare providers in my community about pertussis vaccinations. And you may note that the Advisory Council on Immunization Practice recently recommended some changes to encourage vaccination of persons not currently eligible, or at least not the licensing doesn't approve vaccination for pregnant women and people over age 65. Those people over age 65, Medicare eligible. I noted that the ACA is going to expand services, preventive services to that group. When does that become effective? I'd sure love to tell my community that people over age 65, if they're living with in a household with an infant who can't be vaccinated, I'd like to tell them you can get your TDAP at your provider's office and it's covered under Medicare.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, promoting immunization is a key feature of the preventive aspects of the Affordable Care Act, particularly for the new plans, as I pointed out in the presentation. And many of those provisions are also applicable to public programs like Medicare, and many of the immunization recommendations are also directly relevant to Medicare and other public programs. I'll have to check about that specific immunization, but in general, the push and the theme is to make prevention available for people without cost barriers, and that's where we need to go in the future. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you for your commitment. Thank you.